Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Hiding Carter is professor of public policy here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and we know him well because he's one of our big celebrities who we're privileged to have in town with us. Right now, he's sort of back in the news because of the Academy Award-winning movie Argo, which deals with the hostage crisis in Iran, and that was a part of Hiding Carter's, a big part of Hiding Carter's life. Hiding, how many years ago?
It feels ridiculous, but something like 30, oh my God. It is amazing, 35 years.
Yeah, it's just hard. I can remember running in Charlotte with the yellow ribbons around the tree, and it seems like yesterday in one sense, and another sense it seems
it's World War One in one sense, and the other thing is just yesterday. It's impossible to conceive of it having been so long ago.
What, you've been interviewed so many times. Are you getting tired of talking about this?
I don't mind talking about it because, one, the movie is really good. And two, as those kinds of movies go, it was almost accurate. And three, it was a resurrection for me of a lot of people who mattered to me at the time and who were important to the country. But an event which did not have as much, it had a flare at the beginning and then sort of vanished. So, no, I don't mind it. It's absurd, however, to in any way pretend that I had some kind of central role in that set of events. That was being done by a very brave ambassador from Canada, a very smart CIA guy, and a troop of something out of Shakespeare. I mean,
I would imagine that in your role that there were some things that you were very deliberately not briefed on because you didn't want to be in a position to say, I don't know anything about it, or I don't, or I can't talk about this. You just say, you could honestly say, I don't know about it.
Yeah, of course, the way you actually handled that so you didn't have to lie is just say, you know, we don't talk about that. I mean, and it didn't matter what I did or didn't know. But in almost anything involving intelligence or military action, the State Department briefer was not going to be the guy the first to tell. I mean, and this was the occasion on this one. I mean, I finally did know, but I wasn't the first to know. It was after it began to have some sloppiness around the edges and reporters were coming to me and saying, hey, I think I know something you don't want me to print, so why don't we talk to each
work
other
out a deal.
It.
Let's have a deal.
Yeah, a deal. Sure, a deal is.
I won't publish if you will let me be when it's time to publish. I get to be first.
You give me a big break, which I could promise in all good conscience without knowing for a minute that when it broke, there was no stoppering it. I mean, it just went pow and was gone. And I'm happy to say a couple of those guys had the good grace not to cuss me out.
Some of them. You didn't make multiple promises that they would get first
well,
crack.
We won't go into what that represents, but it was too bad that I couldn't actually pay off a couple of them because they were, in fact, damn good reporters.
Well, you say you're peripheral, and so there's a big argument about whether or not you were in the movie, and there is a report that Kyle Chandler played you in the movie. And do you debunk that? Or
I debunk that he was supposedly playing, or the guy was supposedly playing, and indeed looked so much like Hamilton Jordan that there was no supposedly to it. And as he's walking through one of the rooms, and point this all hell's breaking loose, and a guy says, "Hey, Hiding's on the phone," or words to that effect. And as is usual in those cases and where I was in the pecking order, he said, tell him I'll call him back. I got to see the president.
So you got a mention, but not we didn't get to see.
No, it's too bad because you really could have seen this heroic figure saying I don't have any comment, which was the extent of my fantastic
job. A lot of reels of contemporary footage.
Oh, my God. That was great. Again, the reason I loved it, to be honest, was to see so many of the players that I did know so well, and to resurrect both some of my chief regrets and some of my happiest moments from that. It was a useful movie. My students, of course, truly do think it's World War One.
I know, or Civil War.
Yeah, or Civil War, and that's sort of fun. they say, but my parents, my mom and daddy, they know something about it. And then I realized, of course, mom and daddy were chilling at the time that this was going on.
Well, let's don't get into that because I'm waxed boringly about how I'm feeling my age and in terms of the measuring of what I still believe are contemporary history.
Yes.
President Carter said nice things about the movie, but there seemed to be a reluctance in his description because he felt like too much of the recognition had been given to the CIA operative rather than the Canadian ambassador and his staff, who really, in President Carter's eyes, might have been the real hero. And why is that?
Because when the ambassador, at the first instance, not only let them in, but put them up.
This is
that handful of guys who go out the back door as the mob is seizing everything inside the embassy, the American embassy.
And then
they run ultimately. They get to the Canadian embassy. They are taken in. Now, the act of taking them in was a matter of endangering not merely them or the ambassador, but the entire Canadian apparatus there, because they had already proved that they did not believe in any of the rules of international affairs, engagement about the territorial integrity of an embassy. And there was every reason to think if it leaked, the immediate people who would be the losers would be the ambassador and his staff and that embassy. And he knew what he was doing, and he knew it was a big sweat. So did Canada. So did Canada. And they were not amused.
Yeah.
Not everybody in the capital was amused by his bravery and his integrity and his desire to protect his fellow diplomats from another country. When the story finally broke, Brother Taylor, the ambassador, became perhaps the most lauded man in the United States. I was once sitting next to him at some big thing at the Overseas Press Club in the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, where he was being honored. And as he stood up to be introduced, the entire crowd goes crazy. It is a rock star that they are greeting and cheering. And his quite stunningly bright and attractive wife turned to me and said, "Poor Ken, he's gotten to the point he thinks this is what happens every time he gives a speech and that it should happen each time." But he was understood to be a very important figure at that time.
At the time.
It vanishes. And, of course, the CIA's role was not being flopped around in public, I mean, for all the good reasons, so that's all you really knew. So he had something that was worth getting, which was recognition for his role. Now, the movie, I expect, had more of him in it before they had to edit it, because he does appear from time to time in a nice way, but he's very unhappy, frankly.
He didn't get the recognition.
Yeah, he's unhappy.
And is that because he's getting older?
I would also just think, frankly, if I am looking at something having to do, well, I never did anything heroic, so let's just think about something, you know, and that I had a central role in, and all of a sudden I'm seeing a movie, which in effect says all of that was peripheral to some of the acrobatics that resolved a circumstance that I helped set up, and without me there wouldn't have been. That'd make me unhappy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and it's not looking for another day in the sun. It's actually just looking for a little bit of the record being made clear, as long as we're going to deal with history at all. I want to say again, however, having gone round and round on this subject with so many movies about subjects I knew something about, from the Atlanta child murders years ago, documentary type stuff, Don't look for historical accuracy in most of these things. They cannot jibe dramatic artifice and total truth. And to hear a man as bright as Tony Kushner defending, for instance, in the Lincoln movie, a number of things that are just dead off because it has to be done for artistic license, you know, you understand. You can't expect very much of total accuracy. That being said, it was a really good movie, and I think you got a pretty strong sense of what the atmosphere was like. But the president, I think, was speaking up for somebody he felt strongly about. And he should have, because he didn't. Carter, he didn't have a hell of a lot of people who were playing straight in that deal.
Did the Canadians ever have to pay a price for what they
did? I don't believe that it ever happened. That is, I don't believe there was any retaliation. This is the point at which I have to tell you my ignorance is total. But I never heard anything about it, and I don't think they did.
We're visiting with Hiding Carter. We're talking about the Iranian hostage crisis. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Hiding Carter. And we're in the context of the Academy Award-winning movie Argo, which took us back in time to the Iranian hostage crisis. We're fortunate to have living in our town the guy who explained that crisis to us every day. Those of us who were alive at that point in time. And so we're talking about the Iranian hostage crisis, and I want to talk about it, Hiding, if we can, outside the context of the movie, and sort of getting the benefit of your look back at it right now. And what did we learn? What are the things that we learned that are useful?
It's a good question, because the learners, who never were slow learners, were the people who followed the Carter administration and the Reagan administration, in which they, facing their own hostage-taking events, some of which lasted a lot longer in the Lebanon circumstance and others, went silent. Instead of talking about it every day, responding to questions, when will our prisoners be released, what's going on, they in effect said, we have nothing new to say, that's it, shut it down. Why did that matter? Because it is my certainty now, which probably means I'm wrong, that we, having made this thing the centerpiece of our public presentation in the world, our concern about those hostages, made their overall price go up by a factor of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, that it was suddenly very clear to the other side that this was something that they had even more valuable than they thought it was when they took it. And while the initial taking was done at least semi-spontaneously, thereafter the manipulation of the events became more and more a matter of use to the regime. Look, one of the figures in the movie Argo who's most familiar to those of us who were around, which means you and others, adults, was a guy whose name was Gospodeh, who was a foreign minister of Iran. He was known as the villain. He was cast as a black hat against which the pure and virginal State Department spokesman was cast as a white hat. One day I get a phone call from the White House saying, knock it off. Quit beating up on him. Go silent. Shut up. Knock it. Well, I knew why they were telling me, because we were having direct negotiations with the guy about working out a deal. He was, in fact, not a black hat. He was one of the ones trying to resolve a situation which was actually intolerable for Iran. It had the desired effect for the regime. He was dead within a few months, having been identified as a compromiser and a weasel, is taken out. Why did that matter? It further consolidated the revolution in the hands of the absolute radicals. And over again, they used the hostage question when anybody showed the least inclination to be suggesting that they ought to give up the hostages or have a negotiation with the United States. Gone. Brilliant stuff. And I'm afraid that was the kind of thing that we did not fully appreciate. I did not fully appreciate at the time. And the president's and the administration's reason for having me talk about it all the time was to relieve the pressure from some quarters that we should immediately go do military action, which was certainly felt by the administration to be counterproductive, as it proved out to be later
on. Well, your boss thought it was...
He thought it was absurd. As he said once, I mean, having been Secretary of the Army and Deputy Secretary of Defense, the one thing he knew was you couldn't go across a creek in the middle of the night with a platoon without screwing something up. And the idea that we could go those thousands of miles and make a raid.
When you started, the support of the country was pretty strong for the administration.
It was.
And so there at least be the question, well, the president wants this on the table to further build up support for his administration in general.
Absolutely. And it was disastrous for what was a disastrous thing anyway. But when Teddy Kennedy decided to reestablish Camelot on behalf of everyone who was disappointed by this Southern hick as president, Teddy got himself out there as taking on the president at a time of national crisis and got further and further out there in a way which was disastrous for his prospects, ultimately, except for the core voters in the Democratic Party. So in that way, it was, of course, as for the Ayatollah's people in a different context, a wonderful device to isolate some of your enemies. That worked right on up until it got to be so long into the game and so clearly irresolvable, unresolvable, that there was no winning of points anymore. It was just a negative. I mean, we were running another humiliation and then, of course, the failure of the raid. But by that time, Teddy Kennedy was politically dead as far as the presidential nomination over an incumbent president. And so, sure, that helped the president a lot. There's no question about it. It had good political effect. I'm just saying in the long term, what it did was just make it harder to get those people out. I must say, however, they did all get out, and they all got out alive. And they all got out alive without us having given up anything of principle. And frankly, in the history of hostage taking, which has a lot more antecedents than most people are willing to recognize, from major boats and the North Koreans to people, in the history of hostage taking, that's about as good a result as you ever
have. That's right, but it must have been a kind of kick.
Awful.
Kick in your tummy to lose the election, first of all, to Reagan. And then have the this is clearly get the credit for the hostages coming home. And I mean, what's the diplomatic thing to say about that?
There's nothing diplomatic to say about it except to say, again, those suckers in Tehran are extremely sophisticated about both how to operate in the world in which they think we are the great Satan, but also how to exact the last piece of blood vengeance. And they were getting their vengeance out of Carter's behind by holding on to those hostages until the very second that Reagan was sworn in. That thing could have been done months before.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned earlier that I want to explore, if you will, you said that the your successors in office had learned a lesson in the sense that when hostages are taken in the future, as far as they're concerned, we're not going to give daily reports. We're just going to be quiet about it. And I wonder how far, if you learned that lesson, how far along into the exercise did you start saying, hey, maybe we should quiet this down a little bit?
Never.
Never.
At the time, I was intensely caught up in it. Look, I never want to sound like the guy was saying, hey, guys, I got a better idea than you. I was a faithful and willing and believing instrument in what had been chosen as a path to go. But I will note a couple of things which gave me a little pause. When we were in the intense negotiations, and I'm making up the time, but around April, about the possibility
of
this is 1980. They were seized in November of 79. I have to keep reminding
you.
When we were in the middle of that intense set of negotiations, I was told, stop talking about the whole subject. In effect, just sort of get out of the daily report business. It's not just quit beating up on Gospoday. It's get out of the business. And this is a literal fact, which you can go look up. If it weren't for the fact that Walter Cronkite, by that time, had a sign-off quota, you know, this, the 420th day of the, you know, and that ABC had started an American Held Hostage evening show. But as far as newspapers go, you could watch the whole story begin to vanish. And soon there was virtually nothing in the papers about it because I wasn't providing the necessary white hat to go with the black hats. I wasn't providing the easy melodrama of something to do with those invariable pictures of guys going, huh, in front of the embassy and all of that. And it diminished the story before finally the negotiations collapsed. They happened, the Kennedy people always thought it was always a fake. It wasn't. But it certainly guaranteed that Carter took the Wisconsin primary, which was the end game for Teddy. The Reagan people had an extraordinary opportunity to repeat our mistake. A really fine reporter, I think AP, but in any case, a reporter got taken. His wife, Sis Levin, was absolutely beating the door down because nobody seemed to be doing anything about it. And going to her fellow journalists, her husband's fellow journalists, why are you doing this? And there were others who had been taken in this period, could not get traction, could not ultimately get attention because the administration refused to play. And I hate to say it from my old business, but we're not very good unless we get pointed at things. I mean, that is, if the administration says the place which is a battleground for the future of the free world is Honduras, we suddenly find out where Honduras is, having paid no attention to it at all. I'm making up Honduras. They were talking about El Salvador or Nicaragua. But I mean, you have to have some help in pointing us. I wish that we were simply mirrors of reality. We're often mirrors of what the spokesmen say, and they dropped the ball. So there we were, having taught the folks that. There's not a man in this world, when I get up and say, they had people held hostage longer than we did and to less effect in the end for releasing them, and they say it didn't happen. No, it didn't happen, because nobody was talking about it happening, and therefore it wasn't true, because we don't remember being talked about.
Well, we're visiting with Hiding Carter. We're talking about the Iranian hostage crisis in the context of the recent Academy Award-winning movie Argo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Hiding Carter. We're talking about the Iranian hostage crisis, and he's so generously sharing with us some of the history. Hiding, can we break away from history for just a second?
Sure.
And talk about, we still have not figured out how to talk to the Iranians in a productive way. Why not?
I think that there's very little which is of benefit to the people who run Tehran, who run Iran, to come to a meeting of some kind of accommodation at any rate, because about one of the few little trumps they have in their hands is the constant ability to resurrect the great Satan as being the cause of their multiple failures, and they have multiple failures. It is the oldest demagogic trip in the world. If you want to maintain your position in a world in which you have proved to be a very bad governor, you make sure that you have some either scapegoat or devil right over the horizon to whom you can point and go on. Second thing is, in all truth, the Shah was no less dedicated to their own nuclear option than these people. It is an Iranian notion of national interest to have a substitute for oil when oil begins to run out. And nuclear energy has always been a very important thing. We had to work like hell in the Carter administration to keep the French and others to keep supplying the reactors to do the work that the Shah wanted to do. And these people are just like that. So there's actually nothing in their interest about giving up nuclear, I didn't say bombs, nuclear power. And a lot of Iranians know that who don't agree at all with the regime otherwise. Third thing is that there are those in important foreign policy circles in the United States who do not believe we can maintain an adequate foreign policy or military without some devil of our own. And having lost the Soviet Union as the proximate cause of why we have a military which is larger than all militaries otherwise put together, they've got to have something. This is the immediate and most pressing possibility outside of the rather amorphous, anonymous, the war against terror, which is like the war against sin. I mean, it's always there, but you got to identify which sin and when. Iran is easily identifiable.
Mm. Well, if you were the president and knowing what you know mm-hmm. about Iran, is there a more productive way that we could engage in dialogue with them? Can we back away, or can we find another, or could we find another enemy to sustain our military effort?
Well, we're always finding one. I mean, but what's more, we have real enemies. That's, you can say that about lots of things. But I'm reminded of something. American politics revolved for more than 100 years in many quarters around something called twisting the lion's tail, which was establishing that Britain was our enemy when Britain and we had not been at war since 1812 or thereabouts. But everybody knew that Britain had been the imperial power that we had, in likely event, had overthrown. And politicians just used it like crazy. Whenever they, how'd you get elected mayor of Chicago? You twisted the lion's tail and all of that. I don't think it's easy for people to forget their heritage. We Southerners know doggone well how long it took us to get over our rage Reconstruction and occupation.
But, I mean, are you saying that we've gotten over it?
I didn't say that. But to get over it as a guiding icon of our politics, which it was, at least when you and I were growing up, it was. Icon's not the right word. But in any case, a guiding sort of star for much of our politics. These guys are not going to come easily to it. Is that both administrations, by which I mean right, left, whatever they call themselves in America today, Republican and Democrat, have tried any number of things, reasonable attempts, muscular attempts, deal-making attempts. Poor old Ronald Reagan unlearned his own lesson and suddenly started negotiating indirectly with those folks, but not indirectly at all, in an effort to establish both a possibility of some agreement, but also to get some help in what he wanted to do in Central America. And it was a famous birthday cake and all the rest that got sent over there by the Reagan administration, that muscular administration trying to deal with these people. We've gone down every road anybody can think of except dropping a bomb, which might be the most stupid thing we could possibly do, almost as stupid, well, more stupid than invading Iraq, if you really want to make sure that we have no possibility of any influence in the Middle East at all. Just go ahead and do one more nation-killing thing, as we like to call it when we went into Iraq.
Well, you have to deal with the political reality that the American Republic has a great deal of interest, all different kinds of interest, in the security of Israel, and that complicates—
Very deeply. Very deeply.
Yeah.
Oh, you got it. And that is a very important component. And it doesn't require either paranoia. It certainly is not anti-Semitism. It is a sheer statement of fact that the national security interests of Israel are very important to a lot of Americans, and even more to a lot of politicians who otherwise may not have any interests, but have a lot of interest in staying in office and a lot of interest in having money support from the supporters of Israel. So that we tend often to see that Israel's worst enemies are our worst enemies. Mm-hmm. And while most of the time that's probably true, it is not always true, nor is the approach taken by Israel always necessarily the best approach. No. Why am I conditioning this? It is not always the best approach for us, which has a larger bag of national interests than Israel's security alone.
It's a complicated trap for politicians who are seeking to find a way throughout the world. And our new Secretary of Defense fell into a trap of saying what you look at it in terms of a description. Nobody would argue that the lobbying effort of AIPAC and the those efforts of the Friends of Israel are powerful. They're well funded. They're smart as heck, and they are as
passionate
as they are as. I would just say they're as effective as the NRA in terms of their willingness to confront people who don't agree with them or who are not sufficiently.
And are well placed in both parties, and particularly well placed, interestingly enough, in the Democratic Party, because so many of those who support the Democratic Party also happen to be major supporters of Israel, Jewish or not. And it is a complicated, it's a nice word for it, DG. I'm going to remember that from now on when I think about that area. I will say complicated because it is.
It's not evil. I mean, it's not evil. I mean, because if you do, for anybody who has a strong belief in anything, you go do what you can politically to do that. Well, I'm about to lead us off topic, and we're talking with Hiding Carter. We're talking about diplomacy and in the context of the Iranian hostage crisis, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Hiding Carter's my guest. He's famous again, I mean, in so many ways, and we haven't even talked about college sports. We haven't talked about the newspaper business or the civil rights struggle, all of which, and many other things that are important to the country he's been a part of. But we're fortunate enough to have him living in town this time, Hiding. I'm going to try to stay away from these other topics and to talk about diplomacy and to talk about, if we can, how would you like to be helping President Obama select the foreign policy areas to concentrate on when there's so many? Everything, you know, I mean, we've got, of course, Iran, Iraq, still Afghanistan, Pakistan right there. Then there's China. We got a whole new developing set of crises in Africa, both on both sides of the continent. We have a perhaps greater interest in European stability and integration than we're willing to admit, and see we don't have much influence there. India, I mean, everywhere we go, we've got South America. How would you start being a tutor to the president about foreign policy?
The first thing is, I would certainly not say to this or any other president that I am a tutor for them, because if you ever want to see a guy laugh me out of the room, it would be on that score. However, there are some things which, strangely enough, begin with some of our founding father presidents. One is that you see to it that when we go into the world, we go into the world as the United States of America, and not as a bully, and not as people who believe that it is our divine right to impose our will on every circumstance, and to stop thinking that we have the capacity to adjust affairs in every place which are disturbing to us. I would say, pick the things which are truly important and quit trying to do something about every one. Drop military doctrines that say we can fight 2, 3, 4 kinds of engagements at any given time. Our people in the world ought to be less perceived as, no matter what we really are, as arrogant, and more seen as folks who come with a helping hand rather than an armed club. A hand. I sure would make sure that in every venture that we undertake, we do the complicated business of looking for allies first, as opposed to telling people, get on the plane after we've already taken off. I mean, that one is not a great way to get folks to go with you. If you really want people to cooperate with you in tough things, then you got to be willing to listen before you do them to try to get that kind of cooperation. But go back to the founding fathers. Frankly, one of the most important things we can do for the world is to be the engine that we need to be for the world when it comes to the economy. And that, I mean, is not advanced far enough, though there are 1 million or so jobs created, by defense spending, and a hell of a lot more by making sure that vibrant economic growth is restored. And that's... I'd love to say things like that. They're such cliches. that I even embarrass myself, except that, of course, they get forgotten when all of a sudden we're convinced that the key, and intelligent people are convinced, that the key to a peaceful solution in the Middle East is to invade a sovereign nation which is not at war with us because we don't like them. Now, that, of course, is the kind of thing the Soviet Union was good at. It's a stupid thing for us to do.
Well, talking about the geography, the current challenge day by day is Syria because of ongoing conflict. And the following your rule that you just stated that about the danger of having a military presence in a country in that region versus the challenge of watching a revolution get out of hand and lead to something maybe worse than what the oppressive Assad regime was. So, I mean,
I assume that when those who argue for a muscular presence in Syria are talking about the future, they're talking about a regime which is going to be responsive to what we consider to be the right form of policy in the region and in the world, that is to say, which will not do damage to us and to our friends. What is the way you get an outcome that is as certain in that respect as some people claim the outcome will be if we don't do it? You've just described a possible outcome, the disintegration and then chaos and then the true benefactors being the really bad guys. Tell me who the bad guys are. Tell me who the good guys are. I mean, if you're going to go into a place, at least know who it is that you are trying to prop and who it is and what they want from you. It's everybody we ever do business with always says, you got to give us arms. And we've been doing that with some of the foulest regimes in the world and some of the most needy of small d Democrats. But we don't know how to make distinctions on that. And Syria is one of the tough times. When you filibuster like this, it means you don't really have a policy. You don't have a policy for Syria, all right? Because I don't. And I spent a lot of time, and this sounds weird, but it just happens to be true, studying that section of the world going back. And that's why I thought I was going to go into Foreign Service 100 years ago. And I don't think there's a easy way to unscramble this particular set of eggs, because they got scrambled up so long ago in ways that leave fatal divisions in all these societies unless you put an iron hand up at the top, which, of course, they've had in all these places for all this time. There is, despite the American belief that situations can be handled the same way we handled forests and the way we handle land clearing, which is to flatten everything and start anew, most things can't be handled that way, and there's no overnight solutions to any of it. So the other thing is, whatever we do, make a commitment that we are going to be trying it over time and not over 2 weeks or not over 2 months or not over 6 months. The hardest thing for us in our democracy is to really commit to long term. We are people who are the believers in the possibility of instant sex. And it's just not possible. With Syria, support as best we can. This next step that they've already announced recently on both medical and food help is a good step. If, in fact, the people of Syria are as against the regime as we think they are, being given that kind of help with people as well as fighters is a good way to hasten the day that the regime falls, because we are seen as actually caring about the situation of the populace as opposed to just the fighters. But man, again, I don't know a ready solution. You can't spend generations being participants in the in an assault upon the possibility of the future in a region and in propping up some of the most disgusting rulers in the name of anti-communism or in the name of our need for oil or whatever. You can't do that for all those generations and suddenly go in and be seen as a redeemer. It just, people actually have memories as long as ours.
We're out of time, but before we go, just based on all of this somber stuff you've just fed us, are you still optimistic about this world and about our place in it?
You know what? I'm a Southerner, so are you. Would I have told you 60 years ago that I was optimistic about as much progress as we have made? Hell no, not at all. And here we are. And it makes me optimistic about any number of things which seem to be absolutely insoluble.
Can I stop on that upbeat note?
Sorry.
Hyde and Carter, you've been great. Thanks for sharing this time with us. And thanks to you for listening. It's been D.G. Martin, Who's Talking? I'll be back here before you know it.